Good morning. Today, I discuss the quantization of the Dirac field using Grassmann, so anti-commuting variable by a path integral formalism. And then I hope I have time to start to introduce the quantization of non-abelian gauge series. And of course, Dirac fields are part of it. So first, so quantization for fermions. So path integral and functional integral for fermions. Okay. So I just, in fact, reminded you yesterday of this formalism of anti-commuting numbers, so Grassmann algebra. Whose generator are anti-commuting numbers typically they were denoted, for instance, if you have an algebra with n generators, well, 2n generators, because it's, I was denoting them theta I and theta I bar, where these are the conjugate of these, and that's because we are working on C, but that's quite important in general. And so they obey the fact that the anti-commutes, theta I, theta G, plus theta G, theta I equals zero. We can define the usual rule of integration and differentiation, and basically d over theta I equals d over d theta I. And the anti-commute, again. And with those rules, the important fact is that integration of a d theta bar d theta of exponential of minus some quadratic form gives the determinant of the quadratic form instead of the inverse of the determinant. So that's the basic fact that makes things work. Okay, so there is no quantum theory out of that. Now, we want to quantize a Dirac field, and for that, we can rely on what you have seen a bit with Maite. So I will recall a bit of what is Maite quantum theory, which is that if you have just a single fermion with a single mode, which means simply that you have a system of fermions with two states, no fermions, one fermion, and an Hamiltonian such that H of zero is zero, so the energy of the state with no fermions is zero, and the H of one is, let's call it E0, 1. That's what she called omega. That's the energy of the mode. And you have the standard creation and annihilation operator of fermionic mode, and of course, A dagger of one is zero, and A dagger of one is zero, and A of zero is zero, because you cannot create a second fermion in the same mode, and annihilation of the vacuums gives zero. And if you want to define the evolution operator, so you want to define a path integral for the system. So you want to define a matrix element for the usual evolution operator, which as again is obviously I over h bar t times h. That just it's convenient to introduce some coherent states for the fermions, which I think Maïté doesn't use exactly the same quotation of the one I'm using, but I don't think I'm using, I have notes, this is not in my notes, I think. But you can note some French lecture notes of mine that I can give you. But again, that's standard material, so you can find that in many other books of quantum theory. Okay, so you can define a coherent state with basically you take a generator. So you start from an algebra generated out of two. So you consider an algebra generated out of two elements. So let's call them alpha and alpha bar. Anti-commuting, and you associate one such element at each time. So you have your time, at each time instant, you have one alpha and one alpha bar. So they are functions of t. If you want, this is a, so you have a collection of this. They define an anti-commuting function alpha of t. But you, in fact, you just should view them as a collection of independent generator for the algebra associated to each element of time. They are not really functions. Okay. So you can construct coherent state, and basically a coherent state. Well, with my notation, I think is such that, so a coherent state is a state which lives in the Hilbert space. In fact, it lives in the Hilbert space H times the Grassmann variable, the Grassmann algebra. That's the Hilbert space here, C2. In the space of the quantum theory, which is defined, if I am not mistaken, as 1 minus alpha alpha bar divided by 2 times 0 plus alpha 1. Okay, anyway, what you need to know is that you can define some coherent states which are labeled by the generator of the algebra. It's a bit subtle, you see. And so if you make a change of coordinate in your algebra by mixing the alpha and the alpha bars, the coherent state change. And let me check. It's minus. Yeah, no, it's not. And oh, it's important. It's minus because it's alpha bar alpha. Be careful about the fact that they anti-commute. So you see, this is a combination of vector of the Hilbert space of the fermions times generator, well, elements, because this is a generator, but that's an element of the algebra, it's a product, you see? Okay, so this coherent state belongs to the Hilbert space of the theory times my Grassmann algebra. And then you can define, so now you have a coherent state, you can associate a coherent state associated to each time, because they are alpha for a different time. And it turns out you can define a path integral, which is of the following form. Now you are interested in alpha at time t, quotiented with some. So this is the initial state, and that's the final state. That's okay, so that's the initial state and that's the final state. Okay, so it's going to be a scalar product of element. Okay, so it's a number. Well, I should have defined what is a scalar product, but the scalar product is defined for Grassmann elements is a standard one. Okay, and you can define this basically as some path integral. It's formal path integral. It's a product of all the d alpha bar d alpha at intermediate state. So you start from zero, you end up at t, and you have some intermediate element. And you have some exponential of some action, exponential of I over h bar, some action for this alpha bar of s, alpha of s, so for some histories. So you have an action, a collection of alpha of s at each intermediate step. So that's like a formal history or trajectory or path in Grassmann space. You don't have a mental picture of what's it correspond, like a trajectory in position space, but mathematically it's the same. And with an action, so this action, which is going to be a mixture of Grassmannian number, is something that you can write. So you have a collection of alpha of s and of alpha bar of s. And this action is given, well, formally, like the integral from zero to t of the time. You have an h bar divided by I. And then you have the derivative with respect to s of alpha of s, bar of s, times alpha of s, minus alpha bar of s times the derivative with respect to s of alpha of s, minus e naught. So this is the h bar is in front of the this kinetic term, and then you have e zero alpha bar of s alpha of s, where d over ds of alpha of s means simply, well, if you have some s and some s plus epsilon with a path, this means simply alpha of s plus epsilon. Well, alpha of s is the same thing as alpha of s. So I have an history. Okay, this is the same thing. This is alpha of s plus epsilon minus alpha of s divided by epsilon. So it's just a linear combination of elements of the big Grassmann algebra. So you have a small Grassmann algebra associated to each time, and you have a big Grassmann algebra, which is a product of all these small Grassmann algebra. Okay. And so this is the action. This action involves, you know, products of element, and you see that this involves time derivative. So it's a kinetic term. And this is a potential energy. It's a mass term. It's the energy times alpha bar alpha. Yes?
Where does this action come from?
Pardon?
Where does this expression for the action come from?
It's come from what Maite explain to you. If you look at her notes that I have here, chop. I don't want to. Sorry, I didn't took it. It's still in my office. This formula is in fact called contained in Maite lecture notes. A slightly different notation, but this is contained here. Okay. It's just, it turns out it's exactly the same thing that what you do for quantum mechanics, ordinary quantum mechanics. You divide, you know, an evolution operator in small evolution operator. For small time evolution operator, you write it explicitly in terms of this. You turn the crank, and you get this. Okay.
I think the question is more.
Why?
I think the question is more. Maybe Katie can correct me. Like, what motivates this action? The action that the S. What motivates?
What do you mean by motivate an action?
Like, what inspires you to write down this action?
Well, what inspires this, I think, in the original people who started this game, is to find an analog for fermions of what's happening for particles. So you like to find an action principle to formulate the evolution of a fermion. There is an Hamiltonian way to formulate the dynamics of fermions. It's easy. But to find a Lagrangian formulation is highly non-trivial because you don't have conjugate. You can speak about what is the speed of a fermion in configuration space, what is the velocity. So this is the correct way. It's quite formal, but it's the correct way to define a Lagrangian. If you want, this is a Lagrangian formulation. Or fermions. Okay. So formally, this object it gives you equation of motion. When you make a variation, a functional variation with respect to alpha. You see. And you can check that the equation of motion you obtain are precisely the equation of motion that you get from the Hamiltonian formulation. Okay. For instance, if I'm not mistaken, where is this? With this definition of where is it? Yeah, you can define that if you start from a coherent state alpha at time zero. And you let it evolve with time, you get just here, one is replaced by exponential I E zero times the time, times one. So you see that formally, since one becomes E I over H bar T E naught one, if at time zero, you have a coherent state alpha at time t, you have alpha of t equal e I over t, e over h bar t e zero times alpha. Because it's the coherent state, so if this is the coherent state associated to the Grassmann number alpha, the state at time t is a coherent state associated to the Grassmann number, original Grassmann number, times a phase. And this is a way to realize that.
Isn't that phase only on the one?
Why?
Isn't that phase only on the one? I mean, zero power gives you.
No, because the zero power doesn't change.
Yeah, that's why.
But this doesn't change because alpha bar times alpha becomes one.
Okay, you're putting out.
Because you define alpha of t as e I over h bar t e zero alpha. So this is a Grassmann number. This is a complex number, and alpha bar of t should be its conjugate. So the conjugation is alpha bar for the Grassmann number, and it's the ordinary conjugation for the complex number. So exponential minus I over h bar t e zero. Okay, so you see that everything works. So of course, so this is a so you can view this as a complicated way to write this evolution for the fermionic state, the state with one fermions. But the nice point is that it's similar to what's going on for bosons. You have an integration over, you know, number that depends on time times the exponential of an action. So if you work out everything, it amounts to this. So for just a state with one fermion, that's something which is quite complicated. But the advantage is that one, you have done that, you can do that for more complicated objects. Okay. So this is dynamics of coherent state. Okay. Okay. And those is the other, you know, everything works like that. So once you have that, well, everything works fine for Dirac field. So of course, a Dirac field is an object which is more complicated, but still, I'm considering a free Dirac field. So the free Dirac field obeys the Dirac equation, so it has independent modes, it has free modes. And that's what you have been studying in QFT1, how to quantize the Dirac field by characterizing the eigenmodes, the solution of the Dirac equation, and then creating an Hilbert space by having creation and annihilation operator, creating those modes, obeying, of course, the anti-commuting relation. So you have A times A dagger, but the anti-commutator is one. And then you create the Fock space, or the Hilbert space, as I say. Okay. So now we can do that exactly in the same way using this path integral formulation using Grassmann variables. Because, okay, so the Dirac field, remember, the Dirac field, you have a field psi of x, which is in fact a field with, I have to remember how, yeah, with psi component A of x, so it's a collection Dirac indices. So in two dimension, you have two Dirac indices. In four dimension, you have four Dirac indices. And in general, you have two to the power the smallest integer, less or the greatest integral, less or equal to d divided by two. So you end up two in d equal 2, 4 in d equal 4. That's in order to build a spinor representation of the Lorentz of the Poincaré group. You have a conjugate field psi bar of x, which is psi bar of x. Okay. And the Dirac equation can be written as coming from an action principle with the action. So we have an action. It comes from an action. And the action for a Dirac field is just, so it's a function of those Dirac fields, psi bar and psi, of integral d, well, let me be in four dimensions for simplicity, psi bar of x, I, well, the Dirac derivative with respect to x, minus the mass of the fermions times psi of x, with as usual, d slash x is just gamma mu d over dx mu summed over mu, and the gammas are the Dirac matrices. So the Dirac matrices obey the anti-commuting relation gamma mu gamma nu. And with my notation, I'm going to write this as minus 2 h mu nu, where I take h mu nu is minus plus 1 plus 1. So this is a metric tensor. That's the East Coast metric tensor. But these are the ordinary gamma matrices. So these are, if you want, the West Coast gamma matrices. Because that's a standard notation. Okay. And as long as you deal with a Dirac particle, so the first quantization, psi and psi bar are wave functions. So each component of psi is a wave function of one of the components of the fermion. So they are functions, classical functions. So this action is a classical action. It's a classical action. And if you write the standard Lagrange, Euler-Lagrange equations, you look at the saddle point of this equation, you make a variation, you get Dirac equation. Which is simply I d slash plus m psi of x equals 0. So the Dirac equation is the Euler-Lagrange equation coming from this action because it's quadratic in psi and psi bar. And since it depends on psi just linearly and psi bar, you know, you can write just that delta of the action with respect to psi bar of x equals 0, and you trivially get Dirac equation. You get similarly the corresponding Dirac equation for psi bar. So that's quite trivial. That's because we are in first quantization. Okay. Now, of course, what we want to do is to consider not the Dirac particle, but the Dirac field. So we want to perform to treat the possibility that you have an arbitrary number of fermions and antifermions, particle and antiparticles. Okay, so we want to do second quantization. So we have seen that for the boson, performing second quantization of a Klein-Gordon particles amounts to treat the field as a quantum object. So it amounts to quantize directly the field. So second quantization of a particle theory amounts to first quantization of a field. You directly treat the field as a quantum object. So for the scalar boson, it's a Klein-Gordon field. So, spin zero boson. This is the Klein-Gordon field, Fyrix, which is a scalar field. And for the, therefore, for the spin, 1/2 fermion and antifermions, we expect it to have a spin-off field. Okay. So we want to treat these objects, psi and psi bar, not as functions, but as quantized field. But we want them to obey the Fermi-Dirac statistics. We want these operators to anti-commute instead of commuting. So, well, the receive, so how to treat psi and psi bar as quantum fields, Fermi-Dirac fields. Well, the answer is here. We have a general recipe to quantize a system whose Hilbert space obeys Fermi-Dirac statistics, which is to build this functional integral over Grassmann variable. So we just have to apply the recipe to this action. Apply, if you want, Grassmann, Bérezin, in fact, Bérezin functional integration. Well, of course, Grassmann is a mathematician. He didn't have nothing, but it's Bérezin who applied this formalism to the Dirac equation. So it starts to become formal, but all what we need is to have a recipe which gives the correct calculational rule. So what you have to do is simply that now you consider the Dirac field as a collection of psi A of X. So where both X belongs to Minkowski space, and A goes from 1 to 4, let's say, this is the Dirac index. And psi bar equals psi A bar of X. And we treat each of them, A of X, and psi bar A of X is an independent Grassmann number. So it's a generator of a very big Grassmann algebra. So instead of having some theta i's, you replace the index I by X and A. And we call it psi simply by analogy with the standard notation in physics. You see? So the index, the theta i's of form becomes psi of I equal xa, if you want. Okay. Okay. And then you define an action S of psi and psi bar. Let's call it psi bar and psi. So it's an element of the algebra which is built out of the psi bar and the psi, and it's defined formally as just the integral of a d4x, or an integral of a space time. Space-time And then we just take the standard Dirac action. So we get psi bar of x, well, d slash minus I d slash minus m psi of x, where if you want to be careful about the indices, you have integral over 4x, and you have a sum over the indices of Dirac indices of psi bar a of x, I gamma mu a b d over dx mu minus m delta a b of psi b of x. Okay, just, but now these are Grassmann numbers. Okay. And to define a partition function, Z has a big integral of the psi bar and psi of exponential I times the action. Okay, well, I set h bar equal 1 for simplicity. I have no need of h bar. Okay. And so you see that this action is quadratic in psi bar and psi. Oh, this action. So it's a quadratic form. It's a quadratic form. Simply like here. Simply, it's a quadratic form involving Grassmann variables and their conjugate. And so, this is a Gaussian integral, but a Gaussian integral over Grassmann integral. So this is just the functional determinant of the operator here inside. So this is the functional determinant of I d slash minus m. Okay. And that's something, so this is a partition function, if you want. And as for the free field, the bosonic field, if you want to make sense of this, you have to put your system in a box and take periodic time boundary condition. And if you start from canonical quantization of the Dirac field, compute the partition in a box and with time periodic boundary condition, you get exactly this. You have the products of the eigenmodes of the Dirac field in a box with a finite time. So this result agrees with this canonical quantization. As for the scalar field, everything is fine. Now you can compute also expectation values. Well, according to the rule, expectation values of psi of x, psi bar of y. Vacuum expectation value. Vacuum expectation value or correlation functions. By these rules of functional integration, you compute an integral, but you add some thetas and theta bars. Okay, and we have seen that this is going to be the matrix elements of the inverse of A. So we know from scratch that this is just the inverse element of this operator. So it's 1 over I d slash minus m And well, if you want to compute, here you have a psi a, and here you have a. So this is element x. So this is a kernel between x and y of the matrix element AB of the inverse of this operator. So this is just, if you go to Fourier space, d4k over 2 pi to the power 4, I over minus k slash, well, let me put p because k slash is not very nice, minus m, and you have to perform a Vic rotation, so you get the correct Vic prescription of exponential ip times x minus y, where p is a vector. So this is just the Feynman propagator. For the fermions, it's this object, which is represented like that. Well, it's y to x. And here you have a Dirac index B and a Dirac index A. And this is the matrix element AB of this operator. Okay? So everything works fine. We recover the usual Feynman rules of the yes?
What would happen if we didn't know about commutation relations for fermions? We didn't have canonical quantizations, that our first approach would be this. And we didn't know we have to use Grassmann numbers, and we put like regular things there. What would go wrong?
Well, that's because you have to use Grassmann numbers in order to find that when you have the four psi bar, this is, you get anti-commutation relation for the field. So you need that this object where you have you need Grassmann numbers. In order to have that psi a of x, psi bar b of y, psi c of y, well, of x prime, psi bar d of y prime, is this x, y, x prime, y prime, minus x, y prime, y x prime. Now, of course, you may take psi and psi bar to be complex number, complex field, and then just perform a standard path integral formulation with that. But then the field are not going to obey the Fermi-Dirac statistic. So they will not satisfy, for instance, the spin statistic theorem.
What would it be then? It's something different, something new, or it's something that doesn't
work? No, because the spin statistic theorem relies on the fact that you have a unitarity theory. So unitarity plus Poincaré invariance, if you want. And unitary means positivity. So unitarity means you have positivity of the spectrum, and means that you have so positivity of the amplitude. So you need conservation of the probability, and means that when you have reversion, you have some property when you reverse states. So unitarity and positivity Poincaré invariance implies the spin statistics theorem. Namely, that's so for even spin, you get Bose-Einstein, and for, no, I'm sorry, integer, course. And for half integer, you get Fermi-Dirac. So if you quantize in this way, and if you quantize in a way which preserves Poincaré invariance, that usually you try to do by using this formula, then you have to break of unitarity. You compute, you have amplitudes, and when you compute, you know, some rules for amplitude, you find that some scalar products of states are negative. So you have negative probabilities and higher than one probabilities. Okay. And in fact, next week, we are we'll see an important example in gauge theory. You probably have heard about that, which is that in gauge theories, let me just say it in words. In gauge theories, non-abelian gauge theories, if you quantize naively gauge non-abelian gauge theories by just a naive gauge fixing and don't pay attention to what's going on precisely in the functional integral, you have problem with unitarity. In order to solve this problem, you have to quantize in a precise way. That's what I'm going to present next week. And then you discover that there is a gauge fixing non-trivial term, which is called the Fadeyev-Popov determinant in gauge theories. And it's a determinant. It's a determinant of an operator, which is not this one, but it's another operator involving the gauge field. And the neatest way to represent this determinant is to write it as a functional integral over anti-commuting fields, which are called the ghosts. And of course, if you consider the field theory of ghost fields, namely anti-commuting fields, but which have the ghost turns out to have spin zero. They have spin zero, so they are fermionic bosons. Then you have trouble with unitarity with this theory. But you have already trouble with unitarity for the naively gauge fixed gauge series. And those two non-unitarity terms cancel. So you get, that's one of the beauty of the quantization of gauge theories. So gauge theory requires, if you want to define them properly in a full generality, anti-commuting bosonic fields. But it turns out that the theory is consistent. And this is a feature of gauge theories, but it's also a feature of string theory. So if you are going to follow the courses on string theory, quantization of gauge theories involves a lot of ghosts. Since the string theory have a huge symmetry, internal symmetries. Well, those ghosts appear also in other problems of physics, but okay. So we'll see that later. Okay? Okay, so I think I'll stop this for discussion. So I've explained just that if you perform a functional integral of an anti-commuting field for the Dirac fields, then everything works fine, and you recover the Feynman rules for the Dirac field. So you recover the Feynman propagator, and you recover the fact that you apply the products, you get the Vick theorem for fermions. So you get Feynman factor and Vick theorem for fermions. Okay. So I'll stop there for fermions. We'll come back to them probably at the end of the lecture on gauge theory. But this means that you can, in particular, you can formulate in the same footing quantization of bosonic fields and of fermionic fields. You don't have just to write a pass integral or a functional integral for gauge field and rely just on canonical quantization for fermionic field, which would be very tedious. Okay, so if you have no question, I'm going to switch to gauge series. So, now, a new chapter. So, introduction to non-abelian gauge series. Okay, so you have been introduced to gauge series in QFT1, of course, where you have studied the example of the Maxwell theory. And when you couple it to Dirac fermions, it becomes celebrated quantum electrodynamics. And so it's a theory of spin one vector field. And therefore, they can be described in terms of a vector field. So the vector field is a vector potential. A mu, with mu goes from 1 to 4, or in D dimension. We are in 4 dimensions. Okay. And you know that, in fact, the physical degrees of freedom are not the things you can observe by experiment, are not the vector potential, but the electric and magnetic field, E and B, which are component of the tensor, the electromagnetic tensor, F mu nu, which is D mu A nu, minus D nu A mu, which is the electromagnetic tensor. And you know that the theory, so Maxwell equation can be derived from the fact that you have an action for the Maxwell theory, which is the square of the stress energy tensor. And in addition, you have a gauge invariant. So you have an action principle plus you have a big symmetry, which is a U1 gauge invariance, which means that if you change A mu into A mu plus D mu of alpha, where alpha is alpha of x, is an arbitrary gauge factor, gauge transformation, this is a gauge transformation. Well, you can easily check that F mu nu is unchanged, so E and B. And this entails two sets of constraint equations for E and B. So two equations of a Maxwell theory are obtained by minimizing an action, and two are expressing the gauge invariance of the theory. Because E and B are derivative of something, so you have, when you take derivative of a derivative, you have a consistency equation. Okay, so that's for U1, and it works very well. It's the most beautiful theory of the world, mainly because, for instance, QED, is a wonderful theory. It works. It allows to compute to many, many digit lots of quantum effects. So everything is fine, but of course, when physicists started to extend the idea of gauge theory to vector fields carrying more charge, then they run into trouble. And it went from the 50s, I think, where Young and Mills formulated a theory of, I think it's 54, to the end of the 52, where Toft, Veltman, and then many others showed that non-abelian gauge theories, gauge theory can be renormalized, are renormalizable. Of course, construction of quantum electrodynamics take at least two decades, from the 30s to the 50s, but the construction of non-abelian gauge theories took basically two decades. Okay. So I'm going to discuss what's happening for non-abelian gauge theories based on the SU2 group. Because that's the simplest. Well, it's Young-Mills. Young-Mills, not Young-Mills. No, it's Young-Mills. Okay. So SU2 means we want to deal with a theory which has three charges. So I assume that you are familiar with gauge theory. So in my notes there is some basic standard material about. Representation theory, but I'm sure you are very familiar with that. If not, ask question. And so, let me just start. So I want a theory where I have gauge field coupled to matter fields. For quantization, I'm mostly going to deal with the gauge field, but I have to keep in mind that I want matter fields, a matter field phi is going to be the analog of a charge field in scalar quantum electrodynamics, but it has two components. So phi is phi 1, phi 2. Okay. So it's, let's call it phi I. And I goes from 1 to 2. And it's going to be called the color index, the color indices, because SU2 is a group of a color symmetry. Okay. And it means that I want a theory which, when I take an element G, which belongs to the SU2, so G is a 4x4 matrix. Okay, which is such that it's unitary. So G times G dagger equal 1. A symmetry transformation transform my field phi into the G phi. So this is a 2x2 vector. This is a 2x2 matrix, so this is another two vectors. But it mixes G1 mixes phi1 and phi2, of course, in the standard way. Okay. So I'm dealing with the SU2 group, so this means that phi and phi bar are complex. So they are charged field already. And therefore, you can define the conjugate field which is phi bar, which is composed by phi bar 1 and phi bar 2, where this is bar is a complex conjugate. Okay. And I want an action. So I want, so making a phase rotation is just a U1 symmetry, but I want a theory which is invariant under SU2, which is invariant under this transformation. So, of course, symmetry transformation. Oh, and if you prefer, let me write it in this way. Bar 1 and phi bar 2. So phi is a vector and phi bar is a covector. So in fact, it's a Hermitian conjugate of this vector. Okay. So that I can define that the scalar product phi bar phi is phi bar 1 phi 1 plus phi bar 2 phi 2. And symmetry transformation on phi bar is going to be with this notation phi bar g dagger or g minus 1. Okay, so these are the symmetry transformations. Okay. And then, if I want to consider this field, this scalar field, so this is a scalar field, so it's not a gauge field, it's just a boson. Then I want an SU2 renormalizable action. And the only one must involve the scalar product, because this is invariant. Another symmetry, phi bar phi goes to phi bar phi, because you have g dagger times g, which gives one. Okay, so the only renormalizable action S for the scalar field phi and phi bar is just integral d 4x 1/2 of d mu phi bar times d mu phi plus m squared over 2 phi bar phi plus g over 4, well, let me normalize that again, phi bar phi squared. That's because this is invariant. Okay. So this action is obviously invariant. So it has currents, symmetry currents, conserved currents. But SU2 has three generators. Remember, SU2 has three generators. Which can be written, let's call it TA, which are 1/2 of sigma A, where the sigmas are the Pauli matrices. Okay. So A goes from 1 to 3. Okay. And so in this notation, remember, I start to introduce these indices, A, which 1, 2, and 3 are indices of the adjoint representation of SU2. So it's a Lie algebra of SU2. So it's the algebra of antisymmetric traceless matrices, which is of dimension 3. While the index I, which go from 1 to 2, are indices of the fundamental representation of SU2. Okay. So since, in general, when you have a theory with symmetries, you have one current per generator of the symmetry group, you have three currents. And these three currents are, so you have three currents, let's call it A, with A equal 1, 2, 3. So they are currents. So they are vectors. And G mu A is simply I over 2 phi bar T A d mu phi minus d mu phi bar T A phi. So remember, this is a vector, this is a 2x2 matrix. And this is a covector. So this is a number. But it indexed by mu and by A. So these are the three currents. They are conserved. Namely, for this theory, d mu a equals zero if the equation of motion for the theory is satisfied. And you can group them into a SU2 multiplet, which is going to be an element of the D algebra, simply by writing that G mu is G mu A T A. So this is just a number, this is a field, a scalar field. This is a vector, so this is a vector because you have here. So this is a G mu, each element of G mu is a 2x2 matrix, traceless anti-symmetric matrix. So it's an element of the Lie algebra. It's an element of the Lie algebra of SU2. Okay. And in the notes are explicitly written in terms of the phi and the phi bar. So okay. So I hope if you have any question, just raise your hand. Okay. Now we can do the same thing for spinors. So this is a scalar field. You can play the same game with a spinor field. I just wrote that in the notes. A spinor, a Dirac field, psi will now have two components, psi 1 and psi 2, where each of psi 1 and psi 2 are a Dirac. Okay. Similarly, psi bar is coming to psi pi bar 1 and psi bar 2, with resistors, the Dirac conjugate. The action is again the Dirac action, S equal integral d4x psi bar times I d slash minus m psi. So this is a vector. 2x2 vector, this is a 2x2 vector, and you take its product with a 2x2 covector, so this is a number. Yes?
Is psi 1 itself a
4-component
spinner?
Yes, so this is a Dirac 4-component spinner. So in fact, an element of psi is psi I. A with I going from 1 to 2, but 2 is a group index. And A goes from 1 to 4 is a Dirac index. Okay. And this means sum over A, sum over I, etc. You can organize. Okay. And this action is invariant under this global SU2 symmetry, and the currents are G mu A R psi bar. Ah, it's not a good notation because I have an A here. So let me write the Dirac indices by Greek letters. Okay. Psi mu gamma mu T A psi. So if you prefer. Psi bar alpha gamma mu alpha beta, well, gamma mu, I'm sorry. So index it. Gamma mu alpha beta and psi I T A I G psi G beta. So this is a Dirac matrix. It's a Pauli matrix. It's a 2x2 matrix whose indexes are I and G. This is a Pauli. It's a Dirac matrix whose indexes are alpha, beta, 4x4. It's the current. And you can check that this current is conserved. Those three currents are conserved.
That TA is in the spinor representation.
Pardon?
Like the TAs here in the Dirac field?
The psi I, yes.
The TAs are.
No, the TA are the same than here and the same than here. The TA are. This is the adjoint representation of SU2. Well, of course, the gamma A are generator of the Dirac or spin 1/2 representation of the Lorentz group. So now we have three kinds of indices. We have I, which are group indices, but fundamental representation. Alpha, which are Dirac, so spin 1/2 representation for Lorentz. And the A, what goes from 1 to 3, which are group indices, but group of the adjoint representation of SU2. Okay, so and I hope that I'm going to keep this this notation in the rest of the lecture. Okay. So these are I started with the spin zero field. This is a spin 1/2 field, and now of course. If we want to introduce vector field that carries the charges of this SU2 Young-Mill theory, vector fields, spin 1/1, vector fields, by analogy with Maxwell, what Young and Ennis introduced, is that we have to introduce fields A mu, vector fields, but with index A. One, two, to 3. Because spin 1/2 can be coupled to matter only by through currents. As in electrodynamics, you know, the photon is coupled to the current of electrons, the charge current. So here there are 3 currents. So there must be 3 different kinds of vector fields. Okay. A mu of x. Okay. And they must belong to the adjoint representation of SU2. So they must transform like a current. If you make a transformation, the current mixes. Yeah, it's something that you see, if you change the base of the TAs, then the current change. So the current transform according to the adjoint representation of the current. If you change, you see, if you want the current so they must also belong to the adjoint representation of FCU2. And you can do that by simply performing a multiplet that I'm to call A mu of x, which is sum over A of A mu A of x TA. So those are the 2x2 matrices. So each A mu of x is a 2x2 anti-symmetric traceless matrix, which contains the 3 currents. Okay. So still we have some indices for mu, which means that it's a vector. So if you are a bit familiar with so this is a multiplet of SU2. But if you want to regroup it into an object which transforms covariantly under the Lorentz group, you know that as in quantum in electrodynamics, you can write it as a connection or one form by writing A as sum of a mu of A mu of x, so A of x times the one form dx mu. One differential form. I see. So this is a one form for space time. And that's an adjoint, it belongs to the adjoint representation of SU2. Okay. So this is a convenient notation. And so you must not forget that there are 3 vector fields. So 3 times 4 independent A mu. And they can be regrouped into a multiplet for SU2 and then into a one form, a connection, an SU2 connection.
Space time.
So now we need to define what is a gauge transformation. Because the Maxwell theory, the action for the Maxwell theory comes out from the requirement that we have. We want to have gauge vector fields coupled to the matter field, but in a gauge covariant way. That's the only way to ensure unitarity. So unitarity. Of a theory is satisfied if the theory is gauge invariant. And I think that this issue is a bit problematic, but I think that's equivalent. Okay, so we want to have gauge invariance. So what is gauge invariance for SU2? Gauge invariance one that instead of having a rigid symmetry where the fields phi transform of g phi, well, the same for psi. Psi is going to transform as g psi because they belongs to the fundamental representation. And for A, which belongs to the adjoint representation, a rigid transformation on A it's a matrix, so you can multiply by a matrix to the left and the matrix to the right. So that's how a gauge transformation acts. I'm sorry, that's the opposite, that g minus 1. So this is the way a rigid SU2 symmetry acts on the field. So you see, it mixes the component of A, and similarly for the current, g goes to g. A, g minus 1, so the current get mixed by a symmetry, and the component of the gauge field, the vector field, get mixed, so that because it's the adjoint representation. And we want a gauge symmetry that we require that the theory is invariant under local symmetry. So instead of having a fixed element, you have a, yes?
Is there any reason why, like, because we pick this vector field to couple our currents to, like, whatever our gauge theory is, right?
So yes.
We pick actually a bunch of vector fields that transform under the adjoint representation.
Yes.
Is there any reason other than analogy with QED that we would pick vector fields?
Like, well, the reason is that if we want to keep, you know, those currents that transform according to this symmetry, so they are mixed, that's the only way to proceed.
I couldn't stack a multiplet that transforms under the adjoint representation of spinner fields or anything like that.
I'm thinking about the adjoint representation of SU2. So there's only one adjoint representation of SU2. So,
yeah, but I mean, aren't you picking vector fields, but you're picking three vector fields, right?
Yes. Well, yes.
So why are you picking three vector fields? Why not three spinner fields?
Ah, yeah, but then they would be spin 1/2.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with that.
Ah, okay, yes. But then you cannot couple them to the current because the current, the original three current are vector field.
Oh, it doesn't happen.
So coupling a current means that you need only to have A times G. That's the only way you can couple a vector field to a current.
Right, but that's because you want to match the four components of the current, right? Like the new components of the current?
Well, they amuse the fact that it means that the current is a vector.
Yes, but I mean, if you had a different number of components of the current, like you weren't.
But then I don't think it would be a current in that sense anymore.
Right.
Because the current comes out from just applying Noether's theorem.
Yeah, but it runs.
So a current has to be. So a current has to be G mu equals zero. It has to be conserved.
Yeah.
So it has to be a vector in order that its divergence is a scalar, which is zero.
Right. You can't do any weird mixing with like two spinners that stack up.
Well, you know, if you have spinors, if you have currents which are spinor, well, in fact, this exists, but this exists in supersymmetry. Because in supersymmetric theory, you have additional symmetry that mixes space. And spinor degrees of freedom. So I think you have currents which are spin half current. I'm not very familiar, or let's say I'm not familiar at all with supersymmetry. That's better to state it that way. But in supersymmetry, you have supercurrent.
One more question. That
yes.
dot J you wrote on the board, is that literally a dot product?
Is it?
Is that literally a dot product, A dot J, or is that like a group action?
Yes, I think so.
So
well, we are going to see the precise form of the coupling once we have constructed the gauge series. But this is done by defining covariant derivative. So I'm going to come to that, but on Monday. Yeah. So precise coupling, so a current vector coupling is achieved by covariant derivatives. But I won't have to tell. Okay, so let me just finish what I wanted to say at the beginning. So we want that the theory is invariant under a transformation of this form, but where G is a function, is a local function of X. So G becomes G of X in the same way that here, alpha becomes a function of alpha of x. Because in Maxwell theory, a local gauge transformation on, for instance, the Dirac field means that you change psi of x into ei alpha of x psi of x. This is a local gauge transformation. Okay. And if you perform both this and this transformation, the theory is gauge invariant. So I want to transform here. I have a theory where phi of x is transform of g of x times phi of x. And now the question is, how does A of X must transform? Okay. Okay. And now, of course, this is a global gauge transformation. That's a macroscopic gauge transformation. So this is called gauge transformation. But of course, SU2 is a Lie group. So it's a group where once you have deformed what are infinitesimal transformations, you can reconstruct the whole group. So it's better to consider G of the form to be an infinitesimal representation. So you take G of X to be of the form, the identity matrix plus I times some matrix alpha of X. Oh, I'm sorry, in all my notes I'm using alpha, but this is not the alpha of a vector field. So this alpha is an element. So it's a 2 by 2 anti-symmetric traceless matrix. So alpha of x belongs to the adjoint representation of SU2. So it's a generator of an infinitesimal gauge transformation. Okay. And in this case, of course, if a field belongs to like phi, if phi of x belongs to the adjoint representation, it much transforms according to the multiplication by this. So phi of x is transformed into phi of x plus I alpha of x times phi of x. And remember, this is a two vector, and this is a 2 by 2 matrix. So this is okay. But now, if an object like the current, I'm sorry, that's a fundamental representation. Okay, it's time to finish the lecture. It's a fundamental representation. If an object belongs to the, well, I'm sorry, this is fundamental mental representation. If an object like the current belongs to the adjoint representation, Poisson the current. So let's call it some psi A of x, a field that belongs to the adjoint representation. We should generalize this law of transformation. So there is a 1 plus I alpha to the right and a 1 minus I alpha to the left of A. So a field in the adjoint representation of x transforms into psi A of x plus I times the commutator of alpha of x with psi A of x. Okay? Because here, both objects are 2 by 2 matrices. Because psi A has 3 components. It belongs to the adjoint representation. Okay, so these are the laws of infinitesimal gauge transformation for a vector field, a field in the adjoint representation, a field in the fundamental representation, and a field in the adjoint representation.
What do you mean?
Psi A? Yes, what?
What does psi A?
The adjoints mean A. It's just a field in the adjoint representation. I call it psi. Let's consider a field. For instance, the current is a field, but it's a vector, so it's a, let's consider a field that belongs to the adjoint representation. It means that a field which is in the adjoint representation means that it can be represented as sum from A equal 1 to 3 of the component A of psi times the generator. So this is just a complex field. There are 3 of them. But under a symmetry transformation that mixes according to the rule of the adjoint representation. So if you, these are the generators of SU2, namely 1/2 the sigma matrices. Out of those 3 fields, you made a 2 by 2 matrix, which is an element of the adjoint representation. And the rule that it transformed like that. It transformed like that under symmetric transformation. So for a local gauge transformation, this matrix transforms according to this, the original matrix, plus I times the commutator of alpha of x, the generator of infinitesimal gauge transformation with the field itself. Let me write adjoint. Okay?
So just checking those transformation rules there are for any spin? Like, you're just saying this is how the fundamental wrap?
There is no spin here.
Do there have to be scalars then for this to be?
No, you can do the same thing for if the field is a Dirac spinor.
Okay.
So because you can add some Dirac indices alpha if you want.
Yep.
Because the local Lorentz symmetry of spin is decoupled from the gauge symmetry, so they act independently. So you can add spin indices and consider independently. It's the same for. Same for spinors. So you can take a complex field or Dirac spinor if you like.
Will it work for vector as well?
It will work out as well, yes. And in fact, that's what's going to. But that's Dirac spinor, which are in the adjoint representation and not in the fundamental representation. But I think these exist in more complicated gauge theories, well, unifying theory. Okay. Well, let me stop here. And tomorrow I'm going to start the non-trivial part, which is to see how the gauge field must transform in order for everything to be consistent, which is going to be the generalization of local gauge transformation for the gauge field, which are going to be a generalization of this object. And I explain why this is needed to have a consistent theory. Okay, thank you.